Good morning, and welcome to Lopes on Movies. My name is Joey Lopes, and today I am joined by the only person joining me, which is Connor.
Good morning.
How you doing, Connor? What's going on?
Hey, Joey, I'm doing okay. Congratulations to everybody in the Philadelphia area. It seems like your team is doing great and probably going to win it all.
Come on, don't start the episode on a dour note, Connor.
I just said congratulations.
Being a hater is not easy in times like this. You know,
it's not easy. Doing the early congratulations will jinx them.
Okay. Interesting theory.
Yeah. So Joey, welcome to the Killers of the Flower Moon waiting room, actually.
Yeah, that's exactly what this is, unfortunately. The funny thing is that the movie that we're going to talk about today is one that Mark just watched. So he would have been a perfect person to have on this episode to talk about this movie. However, Mark cannot be joining us for this episode because he is going to an early screening of the new Martin Scorsese movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, which I don't know how he got into that. Somehow he was able to get tickets to that. I don't know how that happened. He has a friend who knows somebody who knows somebody who knows. But, you know, that's not fair. Why does he get to see it first? You know, what did he do to deserve that?
Yeah, and it looks pretty awesome, too.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's Marty. You can't go wrong with Marty.
Marty's the man. It's just kind of interesting that, like, the movie has now gotten a ton of like media attention and advertisements too. And it's funny that before like all the strikes and everything, this movie was not even going to get like a wide release, and now it's like getting a ton of marketing given to it, and it's going wide, really. Of course. So.
Yeah, I wonder if the success of like a movie like Oppenheimer had something to do with the rollout for this being much bigger than I think was originally expected or intended, because that's another like 3 hour long historical movie about like historical events that are very like dark.
I think it's actually 3.5 hours.
Yeah, so it's a long one.
I
like that Scorsese is kind of like in this part of his career, he's like, you know, I don't care anymore. I'm going to make the movie as long as I want, and I'm going to do whatever is necessary to tell the story the way I think it needs to be told. You know, he can do that. You know, there's very few filmmakers who can do that and still make something that's like not ridiculously overindulgent. I mean, some people would say that The Irishman is like ridiculously overindulgent, but not me. That's a great movie for all of its ridiculously long running time. This has been a pretty interesting run of movies from Scorsese in the last couple of years, you know, because The Irishman, of course, is great. I think The Irishman is like such a good movie in the classic Scorsese mob movie style, but it's such a unique and interesting way. The de-aging technology, I think, is the thing that's going to hurt that movie in the long term, because it didn't look great at the time and will probably, like, people will probably continue to make fun of it as the years go on. It doesn't really bother me in terms of the actual quality of the movie and the story being told, but that's, you know, kind of an annoying thing that we'll have to deal with on the legacy of the movie.
I thought it was fine.
Forever,
the parts that I thought were kind of weird with it were the, like, it was clearly an old man who was like doing certain things.
It's the way they move. They move like older men, and like regardless of what the face is telling you. And I think it's fine that the younger faces that they did for the de-aged characters don't look exactly like, you know, that the 40-year-old de-aged De Niro doesn't look like 40-year-old real De Niro. And like whenever, like he was that age, like you go to a movie when he was 40, they don't look exactly the same. I think that's fine. That doesn't bother me. Like some people want like De Niro to look exactly like he looked in Goodfellas in those those older scenes in The Irishman, but like I don't think that that's necessary, and I think it's a different character, and like
it doesn't matter at all. Really, who cares?
That doesn't matter. But I can understand some people finding the de-aging technology to be slightly distracting. But
I'll tell you though, similar, De Niro seems like he's going for it in
Killers of the Flower Moon. Oh yeah. Like he's gonna be chewing the scenery. You know, this is a real De Niro performance from what I understand. But I was just gonna say, like, the de-aging technology reminds me a little bit of something in one of the movies we're gonna talk about today that, like, you could let it distract you and bother you, or you could just not care and have a good time. I'll explain that when we get to that movie. But yeah, this is the Killers of the Flower Moon waiting room. Can't wait to see it. Probably will see it this weekend. As soon as possible. I mean, it opens this week, so probably see it this weekend and maybe talk about it next week on the show. Mm-hmm. So that'll be pretty cool.
Sounds good.
All right, well, before we get to, the Halloween movie, because, you know, it's Halloween season, so we got a horror movie to talk about in a bit. I don't know. I guess that kind of fits. You saw a movie fairly recently that came out in theaters fairly recently that I don't believe we talked about, so I wanted to get a quick take on that from you.
Yeah, I saw Dumb Money. Do you know what this one is, Joey?
From what I understand, Dumb Money is a movie about the like GameStop stock thing that happened a couple years ago or whenever that was. Was it a couple years ago? I actually don't even remember at this point. It feels like it must have been like 2 years at least.
Yep, it was right in the middle of the pandemic, or I guess more beginning part of it, when the GameStop stock was all out of whack. And overinflated due to the Wall Street Bets traders, individual traders and not like the big corporates. It stars Paul Dano, who's playing Roaring Kitty. Do you remember who he was? Did you follow any of the Wall Street Bets?
I followed it a little bit. I mean, I think I don't know for sure that this is the character he's playing, but I think I know or read about this guy. I don't know specifically, but I think so. I think that I recognize the character that he's supposed to be playing.
Yeah, he's one of the guys who wore like a goofy bandana, and I kind of watched this like, while it was happening live. He was a very like interesting kind of goofy guy. Like I can see why people liked him and followed his thing. He would basically just stream himself and show his portfolio and talk about how bullish he was on GameStop and other like stocks like that, but mainly GameStop was the one that that he hyped up so much, and you know, the Wall Street Bets, you know, people were also investing in GameStop. And meanwhile, on the other side, which is the other people who are in this movie, the hedge funds are shorting the stock, so they're basically betting against it like it's going to fail. And so he's doing that, undercutting it. And meanwhile, there's all these, you know, what they call dumb money traders, like Roaring Kitty and everybody, who are buying up the stock. And it's just making it go higher and higher until something has to give at some point. And it's either going to be, you know, the hedge funds lose. And then when the you know, all the individual traders cash out, they make these large gains, or something nefarious happens to kind of save the hedge funds, which is sort of what happened. This also kind of ties into the Robinhood stuff, where Robinhood halted trading on like certain stocks that were going crazy.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
So that's what this movie covers. It's it also stars Vincent D'Onofrio as Steve Cohen, the owner of the New York Mets and .72, hedge fund.
One of the most wealthy people in the world.
Yeah, $13 billion or something. Might be worth more than that, actually. But it's not that it kind of does cast him in like a decent light, I would think. He's obviously just funny. A huge rich guy. Goofy stuff, like he has like a pet pig. Like not even a pig, like a pet hog in the movie for some reason. He's barely in it, but he's pretty much just there to talk to this other hedge fund guy that is Seth Rogen, who's the one that's at least in the movie and also real life too. The character that he's playing is the one that was shorting the GameStop stock so much, and he's kind of given him, I think he worked for, I think in reality that the character that Seth Rogen's playing worked for Steve Cohen at some point. So that's how they have a relationship. But Cohen would basically be calling him and saying, you know, I don't know if this is a good idea that you're doing this and everything, and like kind of advising him like to not. So it's not like he doesn't look that bad in the movie. But yeah, and they obviously make Robin Hood look really bad, of course. Mm-hmm. And Paul Dano gets to be a little bit goofy playing Roaring Kitty. I don't think he's for such a great actor. I think he didn't really get this character. It's kind of like a phone in. It's not a phone in performance, but it's it's just very easy to do, I guess. Mm-hmm. He just kind of shows up at a computer and like is just a little bit awkward ish on there. Totally thankless. Yep, go ahead.
That's kind of my question about the movie. It's like, what is the movie? Like, everything that happened here was people sitting behind their computer screens or on their phones. Like, what is happening in the film?
Well, I mean, they cover all of it. So like, while it's happening, him hyping up the stock, then they go to individual people who are his, like, followers on Wall Street Bets, who you see what their situation is, and then
sure, but is
buying
it just like a bunch
and,
of, like, scenes of people in their houses on screens,
or yeah, or whatever, or just talking to other people that they know. There's a lot of really wooden performances from like the these kids in college and stuff that they're going to, or it's just a weird. Oh, there's so many thankless performances though. Like Dane DeHaan is in this as like a manager at GameStop, and he's just like a jerk to like this employee who ends up being someone who's investing in the GameStop stock, and he's also like weird, but it's like he's not even a tertiary character. He's in it, but like why are you in? You're like you're a leading guy at some point. Now this is the best role. And then Pete Davidson's in it for like comic relief, playing Roaring Kitty's brother, who doesn't, you know, and he does his usual Pete Davidson goofy stuff. That's the only time that the movie is like somewhat entertaining. At spots over, and Nick Offerman's in it too. Like, there's a lot of big actors in a movie like this. And Shailene Woodley, who had a totally thankless role playing Paul Dano's wife, so Roaring Kitty's wife in the movie, is just being this supportive wife character, and that's all. So
naturally,
wouldn't really recommend this one. It was more of a you had to be there kind of thing. I think this is one of those events that people will sort of remember when they were there, but I think it's kind of going to, you know, disappear. I don't know.
It feels like a really subject for a documentary, you know, just like give me a documentary. That would I'd probably find that more.
There's simply just not much there for to be engaged the entire time. So
that's too bad. That's very sad to hear, but luckily the next film we're going to be talking about is definitely not the kind of movie that is lacking in things to keep you engaged. Okay, so this movie we're going to talk about is called Suspiria. You may have heard of it. It's a 1977 Italian supernatural horror film, according to Wikipedia, directed by Dario Argento. It's probably the like Italian horror movie that people like start watching if they decide to get into this sort of subgenre of movies. I think a lot about that Edgar Wright movie recently. What was that movie? I actually can't even remember what that movie was called now. The one with Thomas and Mackenzie and what's her face?
Oh, we did a show on that one too.
Yeah, I know. I literally can't even remember what it's called. One Night in Soho, that movie. With Anya Taylor-Joy. So that movie was very heavily inspired by movies like Suspiria. But we did not really like One Night in Soho, and it felt like a little bit like it wasn't going all the way with what it needed to be, whereas Suspiria is very much a movie that goes all the way with what it needs to be. So yeah, this was one that like I said, Mark had just seen this recently, but he's not here to talk about it. And just because he had seen it, I was like, well, you know, why not? I've always kind of wanted to watch this because this was one that it's almost like a entry level kind of movie. It's like I feel like everybody has seen Suspiria at this point. I feel like I'm a little late on.
I saw it probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's crazy. So yeah, I know. Here we are. I watched it, and I don't know exactly what I was expecting. I probably was at least sort of in the right mindset to experience what it ended up being. But there's a lot of unique things about it that I wasn't necessarily expecting that made me very happy. But so you, I know you said you recently watched like the beginning of it, but like what's your thoughts on Suspiria just generally?
I really like it. I find it's a little bit more, this might be a little harsh to say that it's like more style over substance, but like I think the story is kind of, I mean, I don't hate the story, but it's really not about that. I like where it's set. Like it's set in, well, we didn't even say what the movie is. Basically, it's an American, a girl who comes to Germany to go to this famous dance academy, and caught up in the middle of that is craziness that's going on at the dance academy, and there's a series of murders that have happened, and then there's obviously lots of supernatural stuff that's going on around it. So that's like the basic framework, and I like that aspect of it, that it's kind of that simple. It's the fish out of water that's in an area that she's not totally familiar with. It's like it's kind of unsteady, everything like that. I like that. Other than those things, the story is really not all that's what's important, but what is the style. It's the color palette, the just watching the first 20 minutes of the movie, maybe it's not even the first 20 minutes, maybe the 15 minutes, it goes 0 to 60 immediately. Intensity. But it's also just really stylized. Like you see her, she just gets to Germany. She just gets there from New York. She has her bags. She's in there. The doors open kind of like, you know, just at the airport where she's exiting to get to her cab. Opens the doors and it's a total downpour, like deluge, totally the atmosphere just changes entirely. She's soaking wet like right away, trying to get a cab, and you're immediately uneasy about what's going on.
There's so many like weird things to talk about just in that like 15 seconds of movie.
Yeah,
where it's like, right at the very beginning of the movie, like so you're mentioning the automatic door at the airport. We're like cutting between the automatic door opening and closing, and when it opens, you start to hear like this the part of the musical score of the movie coming in, and then when it closes, the musical score stops. So that's already very strange, because it's like it's using the musical score, like it's not diegetic, but in that the character can't hear it, but it's behaving as if it's being controlled by the doors. So that's weird on its own.
And it's also an uncomfortable, like, I like it, but it plays again and again and again.
Oh, yeah. The song is like, it's that kind of like mysterious, seductive, but sort of sinister. Like, just to be perfectly clear, the music in this movie is to me, one of the best things about it.
Oh, well, no, trust me, it's great,
it's incredible.
It creates like an uneasiness in you. Like, it's a very twinkly kind of sound. Like, not totally unlike Carpenter kind of sounds. I think this is
a little bit,
Goblin,
yeah.
Right?
Goblin. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. But I agree. It's very good. I think it could irritate some people if it's the repetitiveness of it. But I think
it
adds
gets you
to
right in the place you need to be.
No, I completely
it's
agree.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Especially, it captures it immediately. And it's the score, but also just like what's happening around everything.
But it's like, it's not even just that with the, for some reason, the opening of this movie is just like so strange to me. Like when she goes through the automatic door, it cuts to these insert shots of like the mechanism of the door, like super big close-ups of like the way that the door like mechanism works. Did you catch this?
Oh yeah. I'm like, but there's lots of that too.
What is going on here? But then there's like, for the whole rest of this like opening sequence, like the camera is cutting to these just like seemingly just average things, but like zooming in on them and like really, really like sinister close-ups of like I think there's a dam at one point where like you see the water like flowing over it, and the camera just like tracks in on it for some reason. When she gets into the cab, and the whole cab ride is like such a surreal like descent. Like it's probably like a going down the rabbit hole type of intent, but it totally works because this entire cab ride is so bizarre, and like the way that like he shoots the camera outside the door of the cab and like it goes past a street where all the street lights are different colors. It's like, it's just like interesting stuff like that. While this ridiculously powerful and oppressive musical score is like blaring you in the face. So it's like, you know, warning you like, yeah, what's about to happen is going to be insane. And you probably shouldn't go to this dance academy.
Well, then a couple minutes later, you get exactly why you shouldn't go.
You do, yeah. The movie doesn't waste much time showing you an absolutely gruesome murder, but a very, very stylish one. It really is a wild dream. So I think the thing I wanted to talk about with, so I mentioned how like the de-aging in The Irishman distracts people. I think the thing that's going to distract people if they watch Suspiria is the dubbing.
That's just Italian movies
from this era. Like I assume that this is the case even back then in 1977, but before that in the 60s and before that, like on Italian movies, they didn't record any synced or on set audio at all. Like everything was dubbed in post. So you get this like weird uncanny thing where like you can tell generally that the dialogue was not recorded live during the takes, especially if you have like they would have English actors say their lines in English and Italian actors say their lines in Italian and then just dub it over with whatever the language of the movie was later. Mm-hmm. So you end up with like some weird line reading sometimes. Like this is really, really notable and famous in the Dollars trilogy, the Sergio Leone Westerns. But it's something that doesn't bother me at all. And I think it's just like kind of a unique, weird charm of this genre, this like subgenre of Italian movies. So I think that if you really get into this sort of thing, it's something that you'll kind of find endearing. But if you're just watching it for the first time, it might distract you. You might be kind of like weirded out by it.
I think that would be more weird like, for something to happen like nowadays. But for these, for something about like this era and of time, like when it's older, I totally buy it. And I actually think it's kind of interesting because. Oh, yeah. What it does too is it allows the director or you know the studio to have all sorts of actors from different countries and that don't speak the same language. So that's why you have like a lead like Jessica Harper with a lot of Italian actors who would more likely never be in a movie together, you know, or that's like true. The Dollars movies like Clint Eastwood with all these like fantastic Italian actors whereas if they have to speak their one language. It's you know, you might not be able to have a movie together like that. So it's, I don't know, I think it's kind of interesting. You get that kind of eclectic like cast.
Well, it can also be like an interesting tool for the filmmakers. Like I'm pretty sure I don't know which Fellini movie it was. It might have been 8 and a half, and it might have been a different one. But I know that he had talked about how like he didn't really even know what the characters were going to say in the final movie. and like they ended up coming up with a lot of the dialogue after they had already shot it, which is kind of an interesting thing that you like. It's an insane thing that you probably wouldn't do. Like most filmmakers wouldn't do it. But if you're doing something kind of experimental and weird, like it's kind of neat that their focus was almost entirely on the image and what the characters said could be figured out later because they didn't record it anyway. And if they needed to change a line, then they would, you know, why not? There's no harm in doing it. So it's an interesting way to make movies. I think Italian movies are very, very interesting. And I still have plenty more that I need to watch. I've only really seen like some Fellini and some, obviously the Sergio Leone movies are some of my favorite movies of all time. And now I guess this with Dario Argento, but yeah, like just interesting period of cinema for Italian movies. But yeah, I mean, this is just like, it's just one thing after another with cool visuals in this movie. Like, I really love the just facade of the Dance Academy being this like really, really stark red building. Mm-hmm. And you got like the water droplets dripping off of it. Like, it evokes like the look of like dripping blood, which I think is probably on some level intentional. But like, especially with that downpour in the beginning of the movie, you get all these like these close up shots of just parts of the building with the water just dripping down it. In this torrential downpour, it's crazy. I don't know. What are some of your favorite like little visual moments in this?
Well, I mean, the first like sequence I think is my favorite actually. right.
Yeah, I mean, it really is like the perfect like introduction to the movie.
Yeah, I guess a dancer is expelled from this academy. this dance academy and is running off because she's afraid that someone's like chasing her or something. So she eventually finds like a place to stay, and she's still worried that there's someone there. And she uses a bathroom, and there's a window there, and the window immediately like flies open. And then she freaks out, and then she closes it, and or some of her, you know, who she's staying with closes it. And then she kind of goes back and is kind of just staring out at the window. And then you just see these big like yellow eyes like pop out.
And then you
just see a hand fly through the window and grab her. And then the sequences after that of just brutal, like, but still so artfully shot, like sequences in that scene is just so stunning. It's nuts. That's my favorite.
There's just like a million things. The maggots, like that's like probably the most horrifying thing in the movie, with the maggots coming out of the ceiling. Then there's my favorite thing in the movie actually is the worst scene, which is later in the movie when they start explaining some of the supernatural elements, and they have this like psychiatrist character who's like apparently a witch expert, and like, the Jessica Harper character is talking to him, and he's just explaining the plot of what needs to happen. And it's like, it's shot so strangely where like half of it is like the giant widescreen frame is just this, the bald head of this psychiatrist, like covering half of Jessica Harper's face in like the reverse shot. So it's, you can't even see her. All you see is this guy's gigantic bald head. And there's like one shot that's kind of similar to like, you know, in North by Northwest, where there's this shot of the United Nations where like it's a big bird's eye view shot, and Cary Grant's like running out of the United Nations after that guy is killed. You remember that shot? It's like, yeah. It's with a matte painting.
Yeah.
There's a shot exactly like that in this sequence. And it's like, it's so funny because the actual like dialogue and everything that's happening is so like by the numbers, just like gotta get this out of the way story stuff. But it's shot so strange. Like he's trying to come up with any way possible to make this boring scene interesting.
Yeah.
Or at least like weird. And it works. It works. I love it because it's, you know, you could tell that he doesn't really care about the explanation of all the supernatural stuff, but feels like the story needs it to be there. But if, you know, if you're gonna have a scene like that, you might as well make it very, very odd. I'm all about it. This was a great time. To me the music is really like the visuals, of course, are like the most famous thing and the most standout thing, and all those red lights and colored lights and like all the strange choices. But I really don't want to undersell how much the music contributes to the atmosphere, because like as soon as that score kicks in, it puts you on edge and you know something horrible is going to happen. And it just builds and builds and builds until whatever horrible happens does. And it's, you know, always satisfying every time. So, yeah, that's a real horror movie. You know, it's good to watch a real, like, you know, classic, perfectly tuned, violent horror movie from the 70s. You know,
that's a good point too.
Still like, do it like they used to.
As far as like a violent horror movie, like I feel like so many of them that they make nowadays, like those horrible Saw movies or anything, like this is the perfect form of that. Of like,
oh yeah,
a gore and everything tied into a horror movie. Like this is the perfect one. If you're looking for a good film to watch that's spooky during the Halloween season, you gotta, you know, go no further than Suspiria.
Check it out. You may have a good time. You may have fun, but you may also be spooked, which is the perfect, you know, thing. You know, that's what you want when you watch a horror movie, right? All right. We will see you hopefully next week to talk about the new Martin Scorsese movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. But until then, you have a lovely rest of your day.